fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
This is George Butler. What's coming up next is a rebroadcast with Roy Spencer and the book, author of the book, The Blunder, The Great Global Warming, okay? The Great Global Warming Blunder is the name of it. And he really sets out in there what the problem is about global warming from his perspective. He's a doctorate in meteorology and so forth. And so I'd like for you to pay special attention to what he has to say. What has just been released the end of this week by Judicial Watch. Here's a statement coming out of Judicial Watch about a possible security problem on our southern border. Islamic terrorist groups, quote, Islamic terrorist groups are operating in the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez and planning to attack the United States with car bombs or other vehicle-borne and improvised explosive devices, VBIED. High-level federal law enforcement intelligence and other sources have confirmed to Judicial Watch that a warning bulletin for an imminent terrorist attack on the border has been issued. Agents across a number of Homeland Security, Justice, and Defense agencies have all been placed on alert and instructed to aggressively work all possible leads and sources concerning this imminent terrorist threat. Specifically, Judicial Watch sources reveal that the militant group Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, ISIS, is confirmed to now be operating in Juarez, a famously criminal-infested narcotics hotbed situated across from El Paso, Texas. Violent crimes are so rampant in Juarez that the U.S. State Department has issued a number of travel warnings for anyone planning to go there. The last one was issued just a few days ago. It continues on, the statement by Judicial Watch. Intelligence officials have picked up radio talk and chatter indicating that the terrorist groups are going to carry out an attack on the border. According to one Justice Watch source, it's coming very soon. According to this high-level source who clearly identified the groups planning the plots as ISIS and Al-Qaeda, an attack is so imminent that the commanding general of Fort Bliss there in El Paso of the U.S. Army post in El Paso is being briefed. Another source confirmed the Department of Homeland Security did not respond to multiple inquiries from Judicial Watch, both telephonic and in writing, about this information. The disturbing inside intelligence comes on the heels of news reports revealing that U.S. intelligence has picked up increased chatter among Islamic terror networks approaching the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. While these terrorists reportedly plan their attack just outside the U.S., President Obama admits that we don't have a strategy yet to combat ISIS. I don't want to put the cart before the horse, the commander-in-chief said this week during a White House press briefing. I think what I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of what we're at that than we are currently. The administration has also covered up, or at the very least downplayed, a serious epidemic of crime along the Mexican border, even as heavily armed drug cartels have taken over portions of the region. Judicial Watch has reported that the U.S. Border Patrol actually ordered officers to avoid the most crime-infested stretches because they are too dangerous, and patrolling them could result in an international incident of cross-border shooting. In the meantime, who could forget the famous words of Obama's first Homeland Security Secretary, Janet Napolitano? The southern border is as secured as it's ever been. Judicial Watch goes on, these new revelations are bound to impact the current debate about the border crisis and immigration policy. Well, they don't have anything yet, any policy about ISIS over there, and now they're running at all these different scare tactics, and there may or may not be some operating terrorist, you know, cell there in Juarez. I will say this, over the years, Juarez has come to be a very, very dangerous place because of the drug cartels. It just seems to me the drug cartels are more dangerous down there in Mexico than any terrorist group calling itself ISIS or Al-Qaeda ever could be. They've killed a lot more people in Mexico. Thousands, tens of thousands of people are victims and at the hands of the drug cartels in Mexico while we're sitting here, and now we've got this Judicial Watch statement supposedly coming from inside sources saying that there's this great attack coming. Well, I don't know. We'll just have to watch. This came out Friday, and we'll just have to watch more it coming out. So let's be on the watch there on that and just see what might, come out of that. It's hard to say these days. We've seen so many outrageous statements and so forth, that it's really, really difficult, to make statements. Oh, we've got a new book coming out now by Henry Kissinger, okay? And it is going to be a blockbuster, hopefully. Henry Kissinger on the New World Order, and Penguin Books is publishing it. And article in Wall Street Journal, here's what he has to say. He's talking about the state, you know what I mean? Being an old form of government, and that we've got to move past that, and we've got to move into a much more, you know what I mean, governable assembly of nations and so forth. He talks very cryptically about what he believes that where we should move to. I mean, in this article, it's very cryptic. Of course, I guess we all have to go out there and buy that book, I guess, and spend, what, $20, $25 on a hardback version of it. I'm going to go send for one myself on a review copy. So it's just being released here in September, right at the time, right before 9/11. Now we've got these people supposedly knocking on the door down here in Juarez, Mexico, one of the most dangerous drug cartel areas in all of Mexico. So we'll just have to see how that works out. This new book is going to be interesting that Kissinger has coming out. We know that he's Bilderberg, top of the big feeding chain in Bilderberg and so forth. There was a man, O'Keefe, went down there on the border a while back, okay, and dressed up, had a Bin Laden mask on, and just walked across the border and did some video of this, okay? And he published it on the web and did his video and everything else, and the document was released. And so it showed how easy anybody could just walk in, even with a Bin Laden mask on. He wasn't stopped. You could almost jump across the stream there, the Rio Grande in places. So that sort of heightened somewhat concern about the border. And they're saying that was one of the things that maybe gave rise to this new release Judicial Watch has just made. I'm not going for that. The public is just like Gladio, just like Gladio was used as a tensioning mechanism in Western Europe to tension the public and to get them upset and keep them all upset so that they could move them to a new world order. And then we have this Kissinger book coming out about within the first week. Man, crazy, isn't it? Huh? It's not crazy. Stuff is planned out, you know. And we're just sitting here beginning to, what do we do now? And, oh, the New World Order? What is that? You know, but we've got the biggest dummies in the world. They're all into football now. So we've got, you know, okay, we got to go and do football. Yeah. Well, we just came off of baseball. And I guess it's going to overlap some, right? The World Series, you know, and the first season of games in football. Well, we're just going to be dummies, and we're goats, and we're sheep, and they herd us around. And boy, is the American public going to make it on this or not? I hope so, but you know, I lose faith sometimes in the new, you know, the Americans out here that I guess they're just too full of different, you know, fluoride, and they're dumbed down here, and they go to these schools and they don't learn anything, and the core curriculum, and they test, you know what I mean, they give them these tests, these TOS tests, and now it's something else, but the society doesn't get any better. And the reason why is that people are not happy. They're very upset. They come in, they're still coming out of broken homes. You know, the black homes, half the men are not there. And in the other white homes and all that, it's still bad too. So you got all these illegitimate children out here with no fathers. So what kind of society are you going to have, you know? You're just going to have just a complete mess, you know, and that's exactly what it has, evolved into. It's not evolving, it's devolving. You could say that the society is devolving. In other words, it's getting worse. It's not really getting to be a much stronger, more moralistic. You just do your own thing, you know what I mean? And go, we're going to do it. And the Ten Commandments, what's that, you know? And we got all these different people that are so money-driven now that Nothing else matters, you know what I mean? We've got people that are putting out these false books. This Kissinger thing is going to be a mirage of sorts. It's going to put out some kind of an idea that if only, this is my own opinion now about this new Kissinger book, and I haven't read it yet, but I can just pretty well paraphrase it. Not exactly in his terms, but in my terms, in the Patriots' terms. It's going to put out the deal that, you know, we just had a failures. We got all these breakdowns now. And we just got all these failures in government and the world and everything. These mechanisms, these old mechanisms, these institutional things called the state and all that. We've got to move past that into something on a higher level that can bring things together and make it better for everyone, you know. So that's sort of the idea that, and then to do this, we just need a stronger international mechanisms, and we need a new world order, and we've got to set aside the things that we need ourselves, and we're being selfish and greedy. If we want to be successful and have good business in America, we're going to have to give up some of those things. We're just going to have to make sacrifices for the rest of the world, and then we can come forward with a new world order. And that new world order, yeah, we just can't have, to have a secure world, you know, we just can't have the same freedoms that we had before. And my gosh, we just got to have this stuff. Big Brother's going to be good for you, because it's going to be able to decipher those hidden, encrypted between terrorists. And oh gosh, the worst terrorists in the world are going to be these domestic people. Oh, there's a bunch of nuts running around out here. You know who they are. They talk about the Constitution. That's how you know them. If they're out here talking about the Constitution and, oh, we need to get back to it, well, you can better believe and be guaranteed that those are nutcases. The ones that talk about the Constitution are the nutcases. God, don't listen to them. And they want those guns, and those guns are just killing thousands all across the country. And, duh, they talk about gun rights. Oh, that's how you can tell these nutcases. And let me just tick off a series of issues here, and how you can detect these domestic terrorists. For one thing, it's what I just said. They rave about getting back to the Constitution. Look, this country needs to move on to new ground. That old Constitution is not keeping up with the times. That's the argument of the progressive. And number two, oh, they always talk about the Second Amendment and the, oh, if you read that carefully, it says well-regulated militias and everything else. And they, oh, yeah, give them guns to go out and hunt. That's okay. They can do that. But, you know, but no, you just have to control and regulate guns. And having guns at home, my gosh, it kills thousands. And just that argument of, that they make about saving all kinds of lives and protecting themselves from burglary. No, you got to look at all those accidents in there and all those poor little kids that get shot in the homes. And yeah, every once in a while they might shoot a burglar, but you know what? If they didn't have that gun, there wouldn't have been that violence, wouldn't there? Huh? We just can't have that. And the school, oh, they talk about the school system, and they're incessant about that. They're saying, we want to go and do homeschooling. That's how you can tell domestic terrorists. The ones that want to do homeschooling. And you know what? Disregardless, they always put forward all these, well, the children that are homeschooled have higher test scores on SAC, SAT, and all this other stuff. Oh, don't believe that. Yeah, ha, 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 ha. That's because they're not getting a full schooling. They need to know and be socialized like the good progressives and the good liberals need those children to be socialized so they can fit into the new world order. Yeah. Well, you know what schools do? They create a citizen soldier that will defend the state against these so-called enemies. But what it does is protect the wealthy and their property and their value within those state, you know. So what have they done? They just cajoled us and influenced us into being good citizen soldiers to protect the wealth of that 1%, right? And then, way over on the left, the communist socialist left attacks the system of capitalism. But they do not define it properly. They should be attacking crony capitalism or monopolistic capitalism. But no, they just use that term in wide general terms, that capitalism is the problem. So we got these leftists spewing forth all this information that capitalism is the problem. And then the right over here, in their own ignorance at times, is saying, get a job, get a job. And hell, the damn corporations, have taken all the jobs offshore. So a friend of mine once told me, I asked him, I said, Jim Kelly, a good friend of mine, years ago, he's a mentor, one of my mentors. I was like in my 20s, the youngest realtor, off the board of realtors. And I'd go over and have coffee with him. And I asked him, I said, well, how are we going to treat these corporations, Jim? Well, Jim Kelly said, George, it's not a question of how we're going to treat them. The question is, how are they going to treat us? So we have all of these changes in voting where the contributions of the corporation through these PACs and all that are unlimited. Well, that bodes well if you're going to say free market system. But they're too powerful. You've got to limit their giving. If individuals had to give out of their pockets and we restricted it just to individuals, we would then that individual could tie the responsibility of individuals, politicians, back to the people would be more solidly linked that way. Not through the corporations that all they're doing is lobbying Congress for more business. So we get back to the real problem. What is the real problem? We've got a corrupt country. We've got a corrupt community. We've got a corrupt society. They wouldn't go for all of these shenanigans and these criminal acts. And what is it built upon? Built upon a pecking order of mammon worship. So the guy at the top, the Forbes magazines and all that, they'll list all the billionaires in the world. And we can go over and put it on the altar, this big list of billionaires, and we can bow down to it. And we can say, that's what we should really worship right there. And anything else walks, but money talks. You've heard that before. And what do we have as a result of this? Money walks and money talks and the other thing walks, right? We've got just a horrible mess with people like Kissinger and the neocons, and they're running wars at us, and they're right now we don't have a draft, but they might have to get back to that. In some countries, they have to institute a draft. The Ukraine now, those good old boys in the Ukraine are going to start drafting, and then they'll put those kids, those young boys up there on the front lines, and they'll fight those Peruskis. And the Peruskis will draft, and they'll put them up there, and the Israelis will draft, and they'll protect them from these so-called Palestinian terrorists. And then Hamas will be out there gunning everybody else down. They'll be shooting rockets at each other. Men are the problem. But men don't wake up to that. And I know men out there don't like to hear me say this, but men, we're the problem. I'm a man. I'm the problem. Years ago, I began to wake up. I began to see myself in a different way, and I began to know myself. That saying, know thyself, that's very important. And what I saw about myself, I didn't like, because I had committed several of the Ten Commandments. You know, adultery, ran around with these married women. That was not right. I got back into church and began to adhere to the Ten Commandments. And I say for the last 20 years or so, I have not, or 30 years even longer, I have not committed any of those, Ten Commandments or violated those. We've got to get back to doing the right thing for ourselves and for others. But we want to thank you for listening, and we're going to go now to this Roy Spencer, interview about weather, and he does have a very, very different view on it, and it would be to your advantage to listen to what Dr. Roy Spencer has to say about weather. Thank you.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Charlotte, how are you doing this evening? All right, how are those girls? Y'all are out and about, I understand, right?
Yeah, I just got back from a band concert. We had a nice, elegant dinner to raise money for the band. And I've got another one who, actually, they've both stayed to participate in the festivities.
Well, how did it go? Did Rachel and your...
Well, they did.
Okay.
Oh, Rachel plays the flute wonderfully. Yes, yes, yes.
Does
quite
she
cute.
Get...
The third song was a remake of the Flintstones, so I appreciated that one.
All right. Don't you have a violinist or a fiddle player in the family too, or not?
Well, no. The girls did string and vocals. They've percussions. They've done all of them, but Rachel settled on the flute, and Megan settled on percussion. I'm sorry, on vocals. But yeah, they used to. My sister is classically trained violinist. She trained for about 17 years, as far as that goes. And Megan was going to take up that, but we're kind of isolated here, and there's not a lot of violin teachers. So Megan, although we have all the right equipment, we don't have the training facility.
Hey, Charlotte, there may not be violin, but there's fiddle teacher.
Well, Megan wanted to play. You know, she wanted to play country fiddle. So we might.
You know
might
the difference, but country fiddle, really?
Yeah. Well, there's what is the difference?
I'll tell you. That's the way
fiddle,
you put
right?
the. Hey, Charlotte, I can tell you one difference.
What?
a violinist can keep the violin propped up or straight out with their chin, and a fiddle player lays it on their shoulder.
Yeah.
That's about the difference that I've noticed. But anyway, there are some fine violinists that can play into bluegrass, and there's some bluegrass people that are fine classical violinists also. So a lot of these people today have crossed over, you know.
Yeah, which reminds me, George, a lot of our listening audience probably doesn't know about the Give Them a Chance musical drama that you wrote and the 16 original songs that we produced in 2007.
Well, we end our program with the closing song of that musical, Light a Little Candle.
Yeah.
Hey, did you enjoy, when you and the girls were in there, did y'all enjoy performing in there?
Absolutely. The girls, actually, George, they continued to sing the songs, you know, for the next year and a half or two. I mean, the songs were just beautiful. You did a wonderful job. You're quite a multi-talented artist. A lot of people don't know that about you. But, yeah, just it was absolutely beautiful. So,
well,
I miss
the Light a Little Candle song.
That's what
came to me when I was. You know, you had C-Ping Wong last week, right?
Well, first tell me where Light a Little Candle came from, and then I'll tell you about C-Ping Wong.
Well, okay. We'll talk about this later. Our guest is just signed in, so we're not gonna here to talk about our own little victories or even failures. I've had a few. The musical didn't attract much attention, but anyway, we have a fine guest this evening, and his name is Dr. Roy W. Spencer. He received his Ph.D. in meteorology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1981. Before becoming a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville in 2001, he was a senior scientist for climate studies at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, where he and Dr. Christie received NASA's Exceptional Scientific Achievement Award for their global temperature monitoring work with satellites. Now, what we're going to hear from Dr. Spencer later on in his own words is that he used much of the same data and stuff coming off of these satellites to formulate an insightful, a dramatic new approach to global warming. And we want to welcome Dr. Roy W. Spencer. Welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Welcome.
We couldn't have a more exceptional guest than you right now. I think there's great debate about global warming. Lay out some of the debate for us and maybe slip in a little of that global warming 101 off your main page. I think you really get down to the basics and communicate very well through your site.
Well, first of all, the thing we have to clear up that seems to be a matter of confusion in the public's mind is the difference between global warming and the cause of global warming. I run into so many people that think that just because you say global warming or you believe that the Earth is warmed, that it's necessarily due to mankind. And that's not so. There is such a thing as natural climate change. And that's where most of the debate is how much of climate change or global warming that we've had in the last 30 to 50 years, how much of that is natural versus man-made? Because we do know there's such a thing as natural climate change, but the vast majority of the researchers, mainline researchers in this field, simply assume that warming has been man-made. And it's partly because we don't understand natural climate change.
Well, and there's been a huge media push also to lead the general public to believe that it's our carbon footprint, it's our carbon emissions. You know, it's basically commercials on the television are telling us that we're the cause of global warming.
Well, that's very true. I don't think Al Gore in his wildest dreams could have imagined how much this would take off as an issue. And it's partly because it resonates on so many different levels with people. You know, people have very strong beliefs about global warming, even if they don't understand the science. They have religious beliefs, they have philosophical, they have worldview beliefs, they have beliefs about how governments should be involved or not involved in people's daily lives. Economic systems are affected. It touches every aspect of our lives, and that's why, you know, emotions run so high on the subject.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of alternative information out there as well that says that it's the whole solar system is heating up.
Yeah, now, there's all kinds of theories. All of us skeptics do not walk in lockstep on this issue.
Sure.
There's a lot of different theories about what could have caused the warming in the last 30 to 50 years. In my new book, The Great Global Warming Blunder, I talk about our recent satellite research, which suggests that climate change, for the most part, isn't caused by things outside the climate system changing. For instance, you know, the sun changing, or, you know, volcanoes are sort of external to the normal operation of the climate system, not necessarily due to volcanoes. The climate system changes all by itself. You don't need to have some sort of external forcing mechanism. And the primary way that the climate system can change itself is through very small fluctuations in cloudiness. If you change global average cloudiness by 1 or 2%, you have global warming or global cooling.
This
now, that's interesting.
This is the subject of global dimming. Is that right? Global dimming, is that a concept that's very important here?
Well, yes and no. Global dimming is a fairly provocative theory, and I don't think there's really any good observational evidence for it. Our best measurements suggest that there really hasn't been any amount of dimming of the sunlight coming into the Earth. But again, people argue over the data sets as well.
Well, that is our commercial break music coming up. And
we'll
continue
back
on the other side. Thank you.
I agree. Well, it's a matter of degree. I agree that the Earth is, on average, in a state of almost energy balance. In other words, that the amount of sunlight coming in from the Earth, from the sun and being absorbed by the Earth, approximately equals the amount of infrared energy being given off by the Earth back to outer space. Those are the two flows of energy in and out of the Earth that determine whether the climate system warms or cools. Now, this might sound, you know, kind of technical all of a sudden, but it's the same thing as a pot of water on the stove. What determines whether a pot of water on the stove changes in temperature is a matter of how much heat is being pumped into it from the stove, how fast that heat is going into the pot of water, but also it's a matter of how much heat is being lost by the pot of water. When those two flows of energy in and out of the pot of water are equal, you don't have any temperature change. When they're not equal, you have a temperature change. So it all has to do with energy balance, whether it's a pot of water on the stove or the Earth changing its temperature. Now, for global warming, the CO2 that we've put in the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels has upset the flows of energy in and out of the Earth system by about 1%. It's caused a 1% imbalance, okay? But what we, and that number, by the way, cannot be measured from space or anything. We have to calculate it theoretically. It's actually too small of an imbalance to measure from our best satellite instruments. So first of all, the basis for global warming theory is theoretical. It's not observational. But the next point I should make is that Mother Nature causes these kinds of imbalances all the time. And the big bone of contention in this whole debate is how will nature change? Will nature change in such a way to amplify the little bit of warming we get from this energy imbalance from adding CO2 to the atmosphere? Because everyone agrees, all the scientists agree, that direct warming influence from more CO2 is very small. What we disagree about is how the climate system responds in terms of feedbacks, and that makes all the difference in the world. If clouds respond in such a way to amplify the warming, then who knows? You know, Al Gore's Armageddon could be what we're in for. But if clouds respond in such a way to reduce that little bit of warming to even a less amount, then man-made global warming will be lost in the noise of natural climate variability.
Is that a random effect sometimes? Is it hard to predict with any accuracy that those reactions and those dynamics?
Right. The natural variability in the climate system is essentially impossible to predict. About the only kind of climate variability that has some predictability is something that people have already, most people have already heard about, El Nino or La Nina. Those are certain years when, mainly in the wintertime of the northern hemisphere, the tropics settle into a different mode of weather patterns. And if we see an El Nino or a La Nina coming on, then they predict, you know, some months in advance, you know, that it's, we're going to have an El Nino year or a La Nina year. But really the only way they can predict it is because they see it coming on already, and then they just sort of extrapolate out into the future for the next 6 to 12 months. But as far as being able to predict natural climate variations, natural climate change, when nothing has happened yet, we're totally clueless. We have no idea how the climate system varies, and I just call it chaos in the climate system.
Now, you received awards for a special recognition for your work with satellites in climatology. And so what were you specifically, I mean, you just said with great authority that that we can't necessarily measure these changes. They're more observational. Did I understand that correctly? Or they're theoretical? No, they're not observational.
Yeah,
they're theoretical.
Yeah, the basis for man-made global warming theory, in other words, that the extra CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere is causing a warming influence, through the energy imbalance that it imposes on the Earth, that cannot be measured from space. We have, you know, our state-of-the-art radiation balance instruments flying up there on satellites that have cost us billions of dollars, and we still can't measure the small imbalance accurately, so we actually have to calculate it theoretically. So I was just pointing out that the basis for man-made global warming theory is actually a theoretical basis. It's not observational. We can't actually see this. We can't actually measure this imbalance from outer space.
Fascinating.
Doctor, is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation key to the global warming debate?
Yeah, that's my leading candidate for most of the climate variability we've seen in the last 100 years, including the warming we've seen in the last 30 to 50 years. I think it's due to a natural mode of climate variability called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. It's a weather pattern that sets up out over the Pacific, a coupled ocean atmospheric pattern of weather behavior that changes every 30 years or so from a warming phase to a cooling phase. For instance, it was in its warming phase during this warming period up until 1940, when we had globally average warm conditions. And then we had slight cooling into the 70s. That's when the PDO was in a different phase. And then it switched again in the late 70s, and we've had warming ever since. Now, the late 70s up to the present is the modern satellite record. So in other words, the period of time during which we have measured warming is the only period of time that we've had satellites up there to measure the climate system. So it could be that even though we have 30 years of satellite data, up to 30 years of good satellite data, depending on the satellite, that period corresponds to what could be relatively low cloud cover on the Earth, which would then lead to warming. In other words, it could be that what we think of as average cloud cover, normal cloud cover on the Earth based on our satellite measurements, actually isn't normal, that it was different 50 or 60 years ago when the Earth was more in a cooling period. We really don't know. And these are things that are being swept under the rug by the global warming establishment.
So they're right. And can you say the same thing a different way, as in the sense that since we've started measuring, the potential is that there has been less cloud cover and therefore giving sort of a false reading, if you will?
Well, let me put it this way.
Or the opposite, more cloud cover.
Let me put it this way. The warming we've seen in the last 30 years could have been mostly due to a natural decrease in cloud cover of the Earth. It would only take 1%, maybe 2%. There is no way for us to know, because we don't have sufficiently accurate global observations of cloud cover that extends back the 50 or 60 years we would need to know.
Sure, to compare it.
Okay, Doctor, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield.
Welcome back, Dr. Roy W. Spencer.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I have a question. I suspect you fall into the camp of the, quote, you know, global warming deniers. There seem to be some very venomous people in the scientific community that are really lashing out at people like you who have a different view. Have you experienced a lot of backlash from your book?
Some. You know, I get a little bit of hate mail, not much as I would expect. But yeah, that kind of, you know, name calling is annoying from the standpoint that none of us that are skeptical about mankind's influence on the climate system, none of us deny that global warming has happened. You know, in other words, I don't know of any global warming deniers, even amongst us skeptics. So it's, you know, it's just mindless ad hominem attacks is all it is. And it feeds into the sort of the visceral or the emotional, you know, side of this debate that, you know, people that are going to believe what they want to believe no matter what.
What about the idea that, you know, there are going to be attacks on everybody because of this, because of,
yeah,
you know,
carbon tax.
Carbon tax, yeah.
Yeah,
and that,
yeah,
you know, you'll be penalized.
Whether it's through legislation or through regulations, you know, through the EPA. Yeah, that's the ultimate goal politically, is to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, which I think will eventually happen someday. And if there was an easy way to do that, I would say, yeah, we should do it, just to be on the safe side. The trouble is a lot of people apparently don't realize that there are no large-scale replacements for fossil fuels yet. And if we start punishing the use of fossil fuels, which in effect any of these things are going to do, any kind of regulations or legislation is going to raise the price of fossil fuels, it causes the poor that are already living on the edge of poverty or already in poverty, it's going to end up killing people around the world. Just simply because, you know, we can afford it. You know, a lot of us that have a good salary, we can afford higher prices for things, but there's a lot of people in the world that can't. You know, what about the 1 billion people in the world that still do not have electricity? Imagine going without electricity. You know, there's still 1 billion people that don't have electricity and that are on the verge of getting it if, you know, we continue to burn coal. Now, you know, until we find some alternative, whether it's, you know, widespread use of nuclear power or some energy source we don't currently have, then fine. But I'm not going to, you know, I can't in good conscience stand in the way of people in other parts of the world, you know, lifting themselves up out of poverty, allowing themselves to make a better life.
Doctor,
yeah,
are you familiar with the Limits to Growth book?
I haven't read it, but I'm aware of it.
Well, what that spawned was world models. I think World 3 model is what it is. It was a simulation of a world system. Do meteorologists like yourself have certain computer models that you can use to feed variables into and get some kind of results from or not?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, that is the basis for global warming predictions, is computer models of the climate system. Your weather forecasts come from somewhat similar models. They're computer models that are run usually twice a day in different weather forecasting centers around the world. The one for the United States, the main one, is in Washington, D.C. And yeah, you feed data in every 12 hours, weather data from surface measurements, from weather balloons, from jets, you know, that are, you know, commercial jets, feed this data in, and they continuously update these models that then forecast the weather. And they work pretty good out a day or two or three, but beyond some point, the forecasts become basically worthless.
Mm. Now, if I wasn't mistaken, you gentlemen were starting to talk about, if I was following it correctly, the ocean, the ocean tides, El Nino, and those, and you were explaining how they don't know what they're going to get from year to year. What are those indicators that climatologists, meteorologists look to and say, okay, this is going to be, besides the warming temperatures coming in on the mechanisms out in the water that you're taking the temperatures from, but what are there any other warnings besides the water just starting to heat up or cool down?
Traditionally, it's actually a very simple indicator for El Nino and La Nina. It's just the sea level pressure difference between Tahiti and Darwin, Australia. You know, the sea level pressure difference across the Pacific, basically. And that's been used now for over 100 years to monitor the onset or how strong an El Nino or La Nina is. And you know, that pressure difference, of course, is related to winds, which is related to ocean temperatures. It's all connected together. But yeah, that's that's one of the basic indices that are used to monitor El Nino and La Nina.
I mean, there's no correlation to, like, well, gee, we had less cloud cover globally, or...
There is. During El Nino years, typically there's somewhat less cloud cover letting more sunlight in, okay? Now, this is where I think the great global warming blunder has occurred. When we have an unusually warm year, let's say it's an El Nino year, and there's somewhat less cloud cover, climate experts have said, see, this is evidence that when something causes warming, something in the climate system causes warming, that the warming gets amplified by clouds dissipating. And my question always was, how do they know that the warming caused the clouds to dissipate and it wasn't dissipating clouds that caused the warming? And it turns out that they didn't know, and we've got peer-reviewed and published papers on the subject. It comes down to cause versus effect, mixing up cause and effect when watching temperature and cloud variation. Now, this sounds like, you know, sort of a technical, obscure point, but if you don't get the direction of causation right between cloud changes and temperature changes, it makes the difference between a global warming forecast of half a degree in the next 100 years or 5 degrees in the next 100 years. That's how big of a mistake can be made just by mixing up cause and effect when examining cloud behavior in the climate system.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of your profession. When did, you know, people actually become meteorologists and climatologists? I know there were certainly efforts towards it in the past, but when did it become a bona fide science
I would say in the 1940s to support the war effort. Some of the earliest and most famous meteorologists we had were, you know, working during World War II to help do weather forecasts for, let's say, flying bombers to bomb Japan, or for launching the D-Day invasion at Normandy. That's when it first got started. And then into the 50s and 60s, as computers were being developed, the very first use of these computers was to crunch the equations which forecast changes in the atmosphere. So this was the very, you know, beginning of computer modeling, which was weather forecasting, and that's been the basis for climate forecasting. Same kind of techniques are used for computer models to forecast climate change out, let's say, 100 or 200 years.
Right, and if you're not putting the proper inputs in, then you're, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. I get emails and calls from engineers routinely. Very often retired engineers who call and tell me they've been, you know, led these projects to model certain man-made systems, you know, anything man-made that it's kind of complex machinery, where they would try to do computer modeling ahead of time when they're designing the system. And I can't tell you how many of these engineers have said that they could do a great job of modeling all the subsystems, you know, the different components. But when they tried to put them all together in the computer to model the whole system, it would fail. It's just, you know, and you can bet that the climate system is more complicated than any man-made machine.
Doctor, is it these feedbacks and all that that are almost nearly impossible to predict and to program into the computer program?
I'm not going to say impossible. What I'm trying to point out to people is it's a lot more difficult than the scientific consensus makes it sound.
We'll be right back, folks.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you.
Oh, dear. Welcome back to the Sacred Truth. Truth. I'm Charlotte Littlefield.
George Butler here.
Along with George Butler. Welcome back, author of The Great Global Warming Blunder. Dr. Spencer, are you there? Oh, I think we've accidentally lost the line with Dr. Spencer. George, this is some fascinating stuff.
Yes, it is. You know, what he set out before the break was very interesting, and this is what I found to be true in many cases. When you look at these world systems, they can take a few simple systems and try to interrelate them together, but when you have hundreds of different types of systems and you try to work out the synergy between those multiple systems on a synergistic basis, it's very difficult. The algorithm that has to be generated sometimes is almost a variable, sometimes at a random.
Yeah, and I would absolutely, and I would think it would be difficult to determine, you know, because timing would be huge. Quantity, that was a huge challenge, not just priority. You may be able to prioritize and say, well, this has the most effect, and then prioritize them down. But then you have to you know, have timing, and then quantity of, you know, just how much of an effect, and da-da-da. I bet it's extremely complex. And that's,
The fellow that I interviewed over in London during the Copenhagen conference, I think it's Weather Watch or something like that. He says that weather is so unpredictable at times on a random basis. And yeah, okay. Welcome back, Dr. Spencer.
Hey, George.
We lost. You've written the book, The Great Global Warming Blunder, and I want to welcome you back. Sorry, we lost the signal with you there.
No problem, Charlotte.
Yeah. Doctor, we were talking while you were off the air there about it's so difficult with all these different systems on a synergistic basis to write correct algorithms to anticipate everything. What are your ideas on that?
Well, it gets complicated. You know, some people say, how can we forecast climate 50 years in advance when we can't even predict the weather 10 days in advance? Well, it's a little bit of an unfair comparison. Weather forecasting is basically taking a snapshot of the weather at any given time and then using equations to extrapolate out in time, you know, to forecast out in time how the atmosphere will evolve from now on, you know, till tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Climate forecasting, let's say 50 years in advance, is different. Climate forecasting is trying to determine how average weather will change when you change certain rules by which the atmosphere operates. Okay, so there's a difference between the two. Now, that being said, it turns out that there's sort of a gray area that I believe that even if you do try to change the rules by which the atmosphere operates, the atmosphere can push back and change the rules back to the way
Doctor, I like you.
Warms.
You know, you have a sense of humor.
because that's the way the climate system works.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you may be able to, like, line up the various systems and even prioritize, okay, this has an impact, then this and this. But to what degree, and then timing, it just seems like it would be, you know, not impossible but pretty near impossible.
That's right. And this is why you hear news stories about how, let's say, well, for instance, it hasn't warmed in the last about 10 years. And the scientists that are all the experts in global warming are surprised. They don't understand. Why haven't we, you know, why did global warming stop 10 years ago? It should still be warming from the influence of mankind. Well, duh, it's because you all didn't take into account that Mother Nature causes climate change too. And maybe she really doesn't care that much how much CO2 you put into the atmosphere.
Or, because if she has a mechanism, like volcanoes erupting or meteor strikes or anything that would cause large, huge, you know, changes, I would think that there's a homeostasis, you know, like in biology, that finding the equilibrium
The Gaia, doctor. What about Gaia, the concept, principle?
Well, of course, Gaia is a religious concept, the idea that all of life on Earth is what part of one living organism. And, you know, while that, you know, sounds romantic, I don't you know.
I'm talking about Lovelock over there in England.
Yeah, that's he talks about Lovelock's philosophy. Yep.
But also he talked about feedback. Yeah, he got outside of religious too. He talked about these feedback mechanisms also that would stabilize the Earth. Are there mechanisms like that? See, that's another
recent months, he's actually sort of sided with the skeptics on this whole issue.
Well, the way I've seen Gaia or whatever, well, there is this principle of this religious type of thing, but also there's the real physical thing that says there's feedback loops. You know what I mean? And they restabilize the Earth, but over long periods of time. What's your comment?
I do believe that the climate system is dominated by negative feedbacks that are much stronger than the scientific consensus says, and that these things, like you said, they occur on all time scales, and we just don't understand them yet. The climate change as a discipline is very young, in my view, and I think in another 10 years or so, scientists are going to be humbled somewhat and have to admit that they really didn't understand climate as well as they claimed they did back when they forecasted a global warming disaster.
I just hope it doesn't turn into this burdensome world tax on everybody for something that, you know, potentially is not going to be the genesis or, you know, the reason, the cause, and that, you know, and it would be nice to have a cleaner world, if you will. But, you know, it's like you said, everybody has to come on board and everybody has to come along. And it's just way too much of a burden on so many developing economies and families and businesses. I mean, it makes it impossible almost competitively to get into business. You know, if you can't afford the credits or you know, whatever. It's a very difficult thing that the politicians are trying to push based on, you know, so science. It's not, it just doesn't seem to be that valid. And your book is just another example of that. So how is it that you came to write, your book?
Well, this is the second book I've written, and this one, I wrote this book because the new science we're coming up with, I've found that the climate experts are not paying attention, and in fact, they really don't understand what I'm talking about. But when I talk to the public, when I give lectures around the country, I find that the public understands what I'm talking about. When I talk about mixing up cause and effect, the public nods their heads and they understand what I'm talking about. Believe it or not, the scientists, the experts in climate change, do not think in terms of cause and effect. It's true.
They have a dogma. They have a religion. Science is a religion unto itself. And you have certain dogmas and certain fundamental beliefs. They're fundamentalist, reductionist. And anytime you have a system that's fundamentalist, reductionist, and dogmatic, you know, it's really, they can't see what's right in front of them sometimes. And it's true for religion or science.
That's true. Yeah. The way I phrase it is I tell people that science isn't about just measurements. I mean, the measuring things, getting data is the easy part. The hard part in science is figuring out what the measurements are telling you about cause and effect in nature. And that's where scientists' preconceived notions come in, and you can get different theories that are exactly opposite to each other from different scientists. It's all because it's so hard to prove cause and effect.
You know, Doctor, your first book was entitled Climate Confusion, and listen to this, How Global Warming Hysteria Leads to Bad Science, Pandering Politicians, and Misguided Policies That Hurt the Poor. Well, that was a title, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of a long title, but, you know, it's interesting
that the things I talked about in that book, too.
It nails
what you said. It reiterates.
Yeah, that's right. 2 years ago when I wrote that book, it's like now people are starting to talk about those things.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to come back after the top of the hour with our second hour, and, are really enthusiastic about this program tonight. We're learning so much, and our listening audience, I'm sure, is very happy about this program. So we'll come back after the top of the hour.
This is our long break, so if you need to go get a drink of water, now's a good time, and And we'll start the second hour, and we'll go into it. So you wrote two books back-to-back. We'll talk about that when you come back. 2 years, that's not very long in between books. You've got a lot to say.
Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor, for being with us this evening. We'll be right back.